some of the work of Shirley Green. You know Shirley?
Mm-hmm.
Shirley is male. Was doing with the board, and basically he was working with Town and Country Church situations, but also had a history of interest in agricultural problems. Had been with the Farmers Union at one time. And, well, to make a long story short, one of the projects that he had was something called the Goshen Tulare County Ministry in Central California. So this is one of 22 aided fields I was supposed to relate to. I was coming straight from a rural parish in Montana, where I'd spent the first part of the 60s. This was at the time when all of the interest was in urban ministries, civil rights movement, full swing. God had moved to the city, and Harvey Cox was writing the Secular City, and urban church ministry was the name of the Town and Country, and rural ministry was out here, and no bigger to care. But anyway, there were 22 aided fields, and one of them was Goshen Valley County Ministries. The first fall I was here, I went to visit these various aided fields, and one of the trips there.
What was the name of the position and so on at that time?
Well, I was called the Secretary for the Church and Town and Country. There were four of us staff.
Okay.
Anyway, so I arranged to visit the aided fields we had in California, and do that meant to go out to San Francisco and meet Walter Press, who would meet me in his Volvo 1800, and he would end up driving 1,500 miles on that trip around California. But the first part of the trip was the part I remember, because that was when we went down to the Goshen Valley County Ministry. And we got down to Goshen, and of course Jim Drake was running it. It wasn't in Goshen. Jim was down in Delano. And this was November 1965, and there was a grape strike that had just begun. It was had been going for a couple of months. And so Walter says, well, he's not here, we'll go down to Delano. And we went down to Delano and went down to 107 Albany Street, south and north Albany Street there. And, there was Jim with a few other people by the name of Chris Hartmeyer and Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta and Richard Chavez. And they got to talking about what they'd done. I'd read The Grapes of Wrath. I had never really visited farm workers before. I'd never been involved with that. Anyway, to make a long story short, it was clear to me that of all the stuff going on in the 60s, this was largely demonstrations and rhetoric and speeches and movement stuff. This was the one thing that was going to be around 20 years hence, because the person running it was a serious organizer, and there weren't many serious organizers anywhere else. And they were to be serious about building a farm workers union. And my sense was, Town and Country work of the church ought to be involved in social justice issues as much as the urban work. And not only that, this is what we ought to be supporting. So I just was very captivated by Cedar and his realism about building an organization and the fact that the only way the business is one of power and recognition. We're talking about changing lives. We're not talking about empty rhetoric, and we're not talking about providing daycare baskets. But we're talking about changing conditions, which make all those things necessary. So, I had always led a very sheltered life. Grew up, parents were educators, and. They were not poor in the Depression. Educators came through pretty well. I never suffered discrimination, and never had to go through any of that stuff. I was always, not, never wealthy, but comfortable. But my parents did instill in me one thing. They didn't instill in me an interest in church. I didn't see the inside of the church, so I was in college. but they never had anything to do with the church. But they did instill in me a certain sense of values, and not unrelated to Christian values. And one of those was that everybody ought to have fair play. And clearly, farm workers were not getting fair play. So I guess I've always had that feeling. I've always been somewhat angry that people didn't have it, and this is something a reality sport. So that's how I started. Mm-hmm. And of all the things I was doing then, that's the only one that's still going around. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I began to cut out a job for myself at the board, which gradually left the other town and country stuff. But I became more and more involved with organizing and stuff elsewhere.
Is any other denomination doing serious staff work to see to it that organizing is going on?
Well, there's certainly other denominational people involved with it. Yeah, I think the major denominations, certainly the Roman Catholic Church is heavily involved with the Industrial Areas Federation. And while the farm worker ministry initially was Protestant, the Catholics are more and more involved with it. The Presbyterians had work. The Episcopalians have supported things. I don't know that national staff people have had the kind of freedom I've had over the last 20 years to concentrate on this, as I have, and as some other people on staff have. Mm-hmm. We've been very fortunate in this thing. So probably we've had more freedom. More freedom and somewhat less money than somebody else to work with.
Walter Kress talked about the point at which the Northern California Conference stopped providing funds for the National Farm Worker Ministry, but that it didn't hurt him too badly, because by then he said we were getting a lot more funding from the Division of Homeland Ministries than our conference could ever have given. So he said, I just didn't sweat it too much. At what point did the board decide, or had the board been funding the Margaret Ministry all along, or was it, how did that work?
Well, our initial funds were with the Goshen and Orange County Ministry. When Jim went with the California Migrant Ministry, which he did, I managed to get those funds transferred over there. Then, and I can't remember exact dates because they're in the background, but we're talking now really between 1965 and 1968 or so, 1969. The Farm Worker Ministry wrote out a proposal for a worker priest or worker minister project, and we managed to put some funds into that. And then we had also been funding, we also began to fund some work in Texas, for example, with Ed Krueger in the Rio Grande Valley. And another project in Florida dealing with farm workers, separate projects. Let me just deal with UCC funding first. In 1971, when the National Farm Worker Ministry was formed, we decided the decision here to bring all of those funds from those different projects and put them in the National Farm Worker Ministry, so that we could, this way it would give the Farm Worker Ministry some clout nationally. And, so that's how we got involved heavily. I also, before the National Farm Worker Ministry came into being, suggested to Chris that he draw up a proposal for denominations for funding the farm worker ministry work. And I tried to bring people together around that, and I thought we'd be turned on by that issue. And that was how we got some of the, we managed to get some of the work started towards building national support for the farm worker ministry. Fortunately, we had people like John Regeer and Bill Scholes, the National Council of Churches, who could help us do that. So it was something that sort of evolved.
With the really strong support that the UCCs have given to the Farm Worker Ministry and to the Unite Farm Workers over the years, I don't want the question to seem simplistic, but I'd like to know, since you've been a key person in that, what was that based on primarily, that support? What, like for the Catholics, they have particularly one document, but they have a couple of different documents that they have based most of their support of the farm workers on. What for the UCCs was it based on primarily? What major idea or ideas?
Oh, I think this board historically has always been concerned for the emancipation of the disenfranchised and the empowerment of the powerless. We have a long history of supporting migrant ministries, and certainly a long history of supporting human rights and social justice. I don't know if there's any one document. There's a history there which goes back to the days of the American Missionary Association, which was started really to provide education for freed slaves and later got involved with working with racial and ethnic minorities around the country. So it just fits into a long history of what we do. There's no particular document that I can think of.
Now, I'd like to ask you some questions about that 1973 Knight Synod meeting. And I'd be very interested in having you tell me exactly how that all came about. How was it initiated, and how did that happen?
Well, it wasn't planned, I'll tell you. Well, it was planned, and it wasn't planned. I started work the previous fall, before that synod, to try to disfigure whether or not we would be able to get a resolution before the General Synod supporting the United Farm Workers, endorsing the boycott of grapes and lettuce. A bit of lettuce that time. Do you remember, in the 70s?
It would have been both, I think.
Probably
perhaps.
Both. But in any case, the resolution we wanted was to support, to endorse that boycott and support the UFW's efforts to organize nonviolently. Now, I had avoided going to the Synod for resolutions because for a long time I didn't feel we needed to, but I wanted one this time because I wanted to be able to see, our board had, was on record long before supporting the UFW. But we wanted to get a mandate from a broader segment of the church to be able to address the churches on this issue and ask their support for the boycott. To do that, we thought it would be stronger if we had a vote of the General Synod. Howard Sprague, who was our chief executive at that time, was very leery of this. He said, if you lose it, you're in real trouble and so forth. Well, I managed to go through a list of people who work with me, a list of delegates to find out who was going to send it, and I had a pretty good idea we could win it. So by the time we got to Synod, we already had pretty good commitments, quite a number of delegates, and I spoke to a number of caucuses, and there were, I think good indications that we would certainly have more than enough votes to pass a resolution. Well, I think it must have been, I can't remember the exact day of this, since it's 5 days long, but I guess it was sometime during the first day. There was a call that came from Caesar and Coach Shelton. And I don't remember who it came to. I think it probably came to Bob Moss, who was president of the church, or maybe through the Office of Communications, wanting to know if we would be willing to send some observers out to Coachella, if we would be willing to send 6 or 8 people out to Coachella just to see what was happening in front of the Synod. This way it would give some publicity. The Synod was concerned for what was going on in the picket lines and the Teamsters and so forth. So we started working that, and the word got around the Senate. This request had been made. And the next thing we knew, there was a grassroots movement going on in the Senate to send, well, one person, one group wanted to send two 747s out there with the entire General Synod. And I could imagine Chris Hartmeyer at the other end wondering what to do with two 747s for people. You know, citizens, not right. But there was a strong movement afoot. We ought to send a delegation, a solid delegation of people from the Senate to be present there. David Keller, who at that time was in the Farmworker Ministry staff, and also UCC, came to St. Louis, and the boycott staff in St. Louis came over to help us organize a presence. And I called Chris Hartmeyer, and I said, the sentiment to send more than six or eight people, I said, would you consider a plane load? Not two 747, but yeah, he thought he could handle that. So the I'm trying to pick the exact procedure of how this happened, but I'm also trying to who was the head of the boycott staff at St. Louis. Her last name is Welch. Remember her name? That's true. Anyway, she and David were real help in setting up the mechanics. And David's father, who now, wasn't at the time, but who is now conference minister in Missouri, did a lot of telephoning around to find a plane. We had some rather interesting things happen. I tried to get a 747, and some airlines didn't want to touch it. One of the airlines, I don't know whether it was TWA, I think it was TWA, I'm not sure which airline, agreed fine to provide a 707, Boeing 707. Then called us the last minute and said the plane had been commandeered by the president of Brezhnev, who was in the country at the time, which I was somewhat suspicious of. We finally ended up with a Southern Airlines DC-9, which would take us from St. Louis to Ontario. Anyway, David's father worked out the mechanics for that. Meanwhile, the question was, how do we do this? There's a big debate in the Senate. Should we do this? Why don't we just send money? There were all kinds of political factions that didn't want us to get involved. One of the people who, the request was for people in the presence on the picket line to make a testimony for nonviolence. And one of the people who spoke for it very forcefully was Dick Norbert, while he was still conference minister in Northern California. He got up and said, it takes real pain, but we've got to endorse this. And I know what's going to happen when I go back to Northern California. I thought that there was courage to do that. Fred Register, who was the Southern California Conference Minister at the time, was chair of the Executive Council. Was very, very helpful in getting with the Synod to facilitate this happening, and but not publicly. He was behind the scenes working with his support. Fred couldn't go public of it, obviously, he was dealing with that conference. I don't know why that ought to go in the book or not, but...
certainly not without his permission.
Oh, no. But he was very, very supportive, and that was kind of the groundswell for doing this. Almost got to be a real pilgrimage. Then the question is, who goes and how do you pay for the plane? And the formula was worked out that each of our conferences, our 39 conferences, would pay so much. Well, each person on the plane would pay $10. Each of the conferences would be assessed on the basis of how many people they sent for the bulk of the money. And I can still remember Howard Sprague, our executive, who wouldn't speak to me his whole day. He was delighted this was happening, furious I was doing it, I think, because this never could have worked this time we were around for. Senate was involved in other things. They had process consultants of $35,000 for the Senate. We just totally overturned the process. We just completely upset the whole apple cart. So Howard calls me into his office and says, all right, Sonny boy, who's paying for this plane? And I think when I told him, he was absolutely stunned. And as a matter of fact, I was angry. I said, number one, nobody's going to call me Sonny Boy. I'm 40 years old. And number two, the plane is paid for. We ended up saving $500 that the Board of the Homeland Ministries could put into the food. I stayed based on that. I don't want that one paid.
No, I want
that's in the book. So then the question was, who goes? And we had to set up, each conference recognized some people. And we had to insist that, number one, that they subscribe to the nonviolent rules. And we started getting some arguments on this. And I was chair of the meeting. I said, wait a minute, this is not a democratic meeting. You're going on this trip, this is a dictatorial meeting, a dictatorial regime, and you will not. You will subscribe to the nonviolent thing, or you will not go. He said, if we're going to have any trouble on this trip, we're going to have it right here. It's not going to be at the other end. We're going to find enough trouble to get there. And there were three blacks. And the guy, well, the other thing was we had all kinds of people who wanted to be marshals and leaders in this place. And one of these people, I got hold of him and I said, Malcolm, why don't you there were three blacks and Carol and all that wanted to go on this plane with, and they were clearly not into nonviolence. I mean, they were in trouble. And I said, Malcolm, you're gonna have to find a way to get those three off the plane without going. Oh, you can't get them off the plane, they're blacks. We can't tell them they can't go on the plane. I said, but you find a way. They're not going on the plane. And Tennessee City comes back and says, okay, they're not going, they're not members of the United Church of Christ. So, let's see, there was no sleep for 48 hours, and just trying to get all the logistics of this thing going. How do we get to the airport? Malcolm Bertram was to get the buses. Turned out, about the time ago, that he hadn't gotten the buses. Fortunately, the boycott office had anticipated some problems and had a caravan there to take us to the airport. Very nice. They buses meet us in the airport. Let's see, what else in terms of preparing? Oh, the marshals. There were several people, Anne Cohen was one who wanted to be a marshal. Jim Fitch, for feminist reasons. Malcolm Bertram, for God knows what reasons. And one or two others. And, God, did you ever know Jim Hargett? Jim Hargett was a black UCC minister who at that time was working with our Office of Church Life and Leadership. And Jim had been through all the civil rights stuff himself. And he was one of a great sense of humor and a tremendously solid person.
Is he with SCLC?
I don't think so. Not directly. He's always been with UCC. In the Yale Divinity School. So I got Jim over and I said, Jim, you're going to be the real marshal of this trip. Only nobody's going to know it until we get there. You understand what I mean? He said, I understand what you mean. I said, none of these people that are going to be official marshals know what the hell they're doing or what they're getting into. And since you do, and you know what we're going to run into, it's going to be like the summer fridge when we get there. So we need people who understand that. So we left about 9:30 at night, and once we got everything organized, and we had made signs and singing and playing, and we got to Ontario about 2:30 in the morning, or 1:30 in the morning. No, earlier than that. And then we had to wait a couple hours for the buses to arrive. We should get there at 1:30. The buses arrived around 2:30. And people went to sleep on the floor, trying to catch cab maps, and the buses arrived. We had three Greyhound buses, and we got on the buses and went to Coachella. And I was in the lead bus, and I said, when we come into Coachella, I told them how I wanted to come in. I wanted to drive by the Safeway parking lot. If you remember what went on that summer, the Safeway parking lot, one very bright Mercury Baker lamp over this parking lot, was where the hired thugs hired by the Teamsters would meet about 3:30 to 4 in the morning to pick up their various baseball bats and chains and stuff that they were taking to the picket line that day and assembled for the day. And as we came through it there, they all were under this eerie glare. People were saying, who's that? These are people you're going to meet on the picket line. And then we arrived at Central Park in Coachella, and we got off the bus literally into the arms of about 500 farm workers. I mean, it was a very moving thing. Caesar had driven all night from La Paz to get there, was there when the buses came in. And at that point, people were dispersed into, there were 8 groups, and they were taken out to various picket lines. St. Louis that year was very hot. Temperature was in the mid to upper 90s, muggy. When we got to Coachella, it was already that warm at 4:30 in the morning, and it got up to about 115 noontime. And so people were with us. At one point, the Teamsters charged a picket line. And there were people beaten up. None of our people were, but they saw it happen. And confronted for the first time, violent people, some of whom were probably psychotics, who had been taken off the streets of Los Angeles and were being used as much as they were teaching. And also saw the performance of one of the best police forces I've ever known, the Riverside County Sheriff's deputies, their young leader, Paul Yoxhammer, who was unbelievable, you remember him, who died in the following year of a brain tumor, a young guy. Strange, Caesar went to his funeral. Just a super person.
What's his name again?
Paul Yoxhammer. I think it's Yoxhammer, if you take a check there. I had talked with him a number of times, and I was never more impressed with anybody in the police force anywhere. They did a really good job. Absolutely thankless task. You could not see more opposite group than that police force and the one you had in Kern County. It's just the difference between night and day. And I don't recall when we came back. I guess about we left about 3:30 on the plane and flew back. In fact, we've seen it just about 24 hours after we left last night. And everybody was paraded up on the stage for us. And Dave Cato and I went back to the room and watched. And that was fun. Well, it was. It was one of those things that kind of developed. You know, the organizing had taken place before in the sense that we had worked on getting delegates to understand the farm worker issue. So when they came to the Senate, a lot of delegates were prepared to vote to endorse the boycott. They had no idea there was going to be a request to go to Coachella, but because there had been this preparatory work, people said, gee, we can actually do something. And it was caught on. And Bob Moss, who was president of the church, really got caught up in it, too. And he was excited about it.
Where was he from?
President of the church? Well, he'd been president of Lancaster Seminary before he came to the president general.
Pennsylvania?
Yeah. While he was president, he lived in Montclair. So, died of cancer at age 54 while he was president. His wife is now married to Tracy Jones, who was the former head of the Methodist World War Ministries. And they were not very, very good friends.
When they came back, I heard all the little brief comments that people made, which were very impressive. Was there ever a boycott resolution passed at that meeting?
Interestingly enough, because of the business of the Senate, they were not able to do it at the meeting. But there is a procedure whereby stuff that isn't covered at the meeting, the Executive Council can pass later. And it was later than what, on behalf of the Senate. Mm-hmm. And it was agreed that that would be done. I don't remember exactly what that resolution was, but there was a resolution of endorsement and support passed, mm-hmm. which made official everything that had happened at the Senate. But, you couldn't have a much stronger vote of the Senate than you had in supporting this whole thing.
What percentage of the delegates went, or how many do you usually have at a general Senate meeting?
Oh gosh, I think it's somewhere around 750 official delegates. I have to check that out.
So,
but there were maybe 2,000 people there because we did a lot of it.
So about a tenth of the entire delegation.
I need to say also that the people who went on that plane, that group of people became a network for a good 5 or 6 years afterwards, who I could communicate with and who would support any action we take, literally, among the churches in their own their own communities. One of those people I know who went was a member of the Farm Bureau from Illinois. He left. When he came back, he was totally converted to the USW's position. So there is nothing like an event like that for pure education. I'm not saying one should do this every Sunday or every year, but it came at a very good time when, following that event, we could call on people all over the country, UCC, to come out and support farmers. And I was convinced that the best way to involve church people in this is, ask churches to take a vote on the issue. And if you lose the vote in the church, you still win a number of people who are supporters. Mm-hmm. The issue is to get more and more people supporting the great point. So you ask churches to vote on it, bring it up, discuss it, and vote on it. And of course you want to win the vote, but if you don't win the vote, you still gain supporters. And the issue is not so much the vote as trying to get people from the UCC involved who help support the boycott. And we were able to do that after that for 4 or 5 years. So it was a fun time in that respect.
Did you see any other results? Have you seen any structural results in the institution, this denomination, from the involvement of the United Farm Workers?
What do you mean by structural results?
Impact on the thinking of leadership that result in changed job descriptions or that kind of thing.
No, I think not. There was obviously some support for farm workers. There was also some real professional jealousy on the part of people who were frankly concerned with dealing with some other issues, which were equally valid in their own right, understandable. But there's always that kind of sense. But, no, there were no real structural changes. The best thing that happened was that for 4 or 5 years, we had a network of people who could mobilize quite a lot of people in their own areas for support on the farm worker issues. And provide an educational network. But no, I would have to say no basic structural work changes, no staff changes.
What was some of the negative fallout? There was some jealousy in terms of other issues.
I don't know that there was any really negative fallout. That's fairly normal cause of stress. Mm-hmm. But I don't recall any really negative fallout. We had, there were always from time to time letters from people who were unhappy with our supporting the UFW, but surprisingly few of those. Really. I was prepared for a lot more of those letters than I ever got. And part of it was, I think, it came up before conferences, and these people all went back to their state conferences and reported on this whole issue. So there was really a remarkably broad base of support within the UCC for the farm worker cause. It's not to say we didn't have an opponent, sure we had our opponents. But also by that time, a lot of the flak stuff had worn off because we'd been involved with them since 1965 in one way or the other. So. That montage, by the way, goes from 1965 to 1973.
I was going to ask you about that.
And then the year of the Teamsters, that was the last. Somewhere in there, Dorothy Day is being arrested.
Yeah, that famous picture.
Yeah, I know where it is.
It's a wonderful picture.
That montage is going to disappear this year.
To your home?
No, it's going to, no, I can't preserve it. It'll crumble.
You'll take a picture of it first.
I suppose I should.
Yeah, I think you should.
I don't know how I could, actually. Maybe wide angle lens, but I could. Take a slide.
I'd also like to ask you about something that you may not know that much about because you were in Coachella, but I understand from Dick Norberg that the people who stayed decided to invest
some of their time visiting stores and some corporation headquarters, but he couldn't remember what it was.
It was a chain in St. Louis. Barbara Welsh Foster. Gosh, that's terrible. Dave Cater would remember her name. Richard Cook would probably know her name. Anyway, the boycott office, the boycott staff in St. Louis took people from there, and they went out. It seems to me they visited the Teamster headquarters. There was some local support, Teamster support in St. Louis, if I recall. And they went and visited the stores that were being boycotted. But I don't remember the details of that. But that's true, they did.
I wanted to
I'd be interested to
know that.
Yeah. I'd be interested in Dick's perspective on this whole thing, too.
Yeah, oh, well, he loved talking about it. Mm. But he saw it all from a little different angle than you did, because his involvements, of course, were different and not as central as your own.
Well, one of the funny things about Malcolm Bertram, he was a minister in Sciences. I don't know what it's on. This is probably different quote. But Malcolm was the one who was behind this whole thing to get 2 747s. And ironically, if I learned about that from Dick Fernandez, who was down in the lower lobby, always sneaking around the edges of things, the old ways, you better go find out what that's about. So I went up to this room, and here these two people sitting around, they had Marbury, I think, was there. Mm-hmm. And I began raising questions as to whether or not 2747 has really made a great deal of sense in terms of logistics. It might be a problem at the other end. And Malcolm Burgess, there you go. National staff trying to squelch a grassroots movement to church, right like that. And Dick Norberg, who knew my involvement as a farmer, just broke up with his voice. Broke up laughing. This guy, he was furious. The idea of squelching this great movement with the church. You know? I couldn't convince him that maybe this is not what would be most helpful to farm workers, and it might be very helpful to Mal Bertram, but it wasn't going to help farm workers. It certainly wasn't going to be helpful to Chris Hartmeyer, who had to operate the logistics at the other end of the line.
Can you imagine just moving all those people? Good grief. What a headache.
Anyway, then, you know, Malcolm had trouble producing with the hand. Oh, he carried on. He was he never. Poor Malcolm. He was really I'm afraid of an ego trip on that whole thing.
How has your involvement with the farm worker movement changed you, or has it?
Well, I guess really the farm worker ministry is why I'm with the board today, why I stayed with the board. I really knew nothing about organizing until I got involved with it. I think what I did in the early days of that movement was to spend at least a couple of weeks a year out in the field offices or picket lines with the farm workers to get to know the situation and what people did. Jim Drake was most helpful in that. And I just saw this as one of the very exciting things the church was doing in the legitimate ministry of the church. And I also began through this experience to learn what organizing is really about, the issues of power in organizing. There's some ideology in all of this, but basically you're dealing with the ideology that's not translated into pragmatic strategy is wasted rhetoric. And Caesar, who had certain ideological convictions, was very good at translating those into pragmatism, so that you have a concrete translation of idealism into something into action. Then after that, I got involved into other organizing efforts. One of the things I was asked to do by this board was to explore ways in which we could become involved with Hispanics in this country. This board didn't have anything in the way of programming. And we did have a relationship with Ernie Cortez, who was working in San Antonio, Community Council. I spent a lot of time with Ernie. In fact, tried one time to encourage Ernie to go to farm workers and do something where there's some organizing going on. That's a whole other story. But Ernie introduced me to Ed Chambers at the IAF. And that was just one step farther into organizing and helping me to realize the thrust of the church's ministry in terms of justice and working with the poor really needs to be here issue for all these people's powerlessness. Ultimately, the ministry of the church to the powerless has to be to help them gain power. That's what it's about. Otherwise, anything else is rhetoric. You always have to define power because those who are in comfortable sanctuaries of ecclesiastical structure always like to think of power in terms of its abuses, but power is neutral term. It's basically amoral. It's really the classic definition is that power is the ability to act in one's own behalf. And, you know, a lot of people don't have that, and should have a right to that. Should be able to act on their own behalf. So I guess the farm worker ministry, or the farmer, Cesar Chavez really was the one who started me in thinking in terms of how you go about dealing with it. Helping me to see that demonstrations and sit-ins and rallies and moving speeches and even political votes in Congress wasn't enough. If you didn't have power to hold public officials accountable and to force government to enforce laws that are enacted, that nothing really changes. And the civil rights movement, for all of its glory, really didn't build power among the blacks. It did create national attention. It created media events. It brought legislation. And it made real changes, and I don't by any means mean to say there weren't changes made. They were not about the business, however, of serious organizing at that time. And at the time of this was also in the late 60s, of course, we were in the Vietnam War, and all the anti-war movement stuff, none of that was organizing, and which is why it wasn't very effective. We had rallies and speeches, but nobody was building a serious organization to hold political figures who had power accountable. Except the United Farm Workers and the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was beginning to do that. Alinsky died about 1971 or two, and Ed Chambers took over as the head of that and began to build a serious network of professional organizers and citizens' organizations. I think the Farm Worker Ministry started me thinking in these terms. It's very important in my life. It's made my ministry here as a board. Because my ministry, I don't do organizing. Our job here is to provide resources for those who do. And part of that process is to look for funds, but also for talent, and also be able to assess talent, and be able to assess what's serious organizing and what isn't serious organizing. So it's, I think somebody needs to be doing that at the national level. Whether it's going to continue with this board, I don't know. I may know next week.
What do you think the future should be for the National Farm Worker Ministry? What do you think?
Can I take a break?
Sure.
I want to call my wife just to see if the power is on.
But what do you think the future of the Farm Worker Ministry should be? Do you have a vision for it?
I think we're in a state of real transition right now. I think that ultimately the National Farm Worker Ministry is going to have to look beyond the UFW. Unless the UFW seriously moves out of California into other areas, if we're going to be a National Farm Worker Ministry. This is not to say I think we should withdraw or in any way diminish our support of the UFW, but our relationship with the UFW today is by very nature of the situation different from what it was 15 years ago. The farm workers today are an established union, they have established headquarters, they have real power. They are not in the state of what they were in 1965 and in the early days of the grape strikes. the farm worker ministry will always have a role, I think, with the union, as long as the union wants them there, in terms of providing some people with skills, both pastoral and others, other kinds of technical skills. I also think, though, the farm worker ministry on behalf of the churches has to look at places where farm workers are not organized, and where perhaps they could be organized or need to be organized, and to address the questions of what happens here. We have, over the past 2 years, been relating more closely to flock. And part of the future is going to be determined by what happens in the whole business of farm worker organizing. But it may be the farm worker ministry needs to be more aggressive than it has been in terms of seeking talent or the possibility of organizing in other areas, if the UFW is not going to do that. I don't know that I want that in the book. I'm not trying to suggest in any way we detract from the UFW, but we at least have to be cognizant of the fact that there are, you know, 1 million farm workers out there that aren't covered by contracts and are not really related to the UFW. And there are a lot of other, quote, farm worker groups, but none of them doing serious organizing that I see today. I think the future is going to depend to some degree on the leadership of the ministry. And, you know, right now with Fred, we have somebody who's a good administrator, and he's very dedicated to supporting the UFW, and the UFW has asked the ministry now to do some very specific things on the Great Boycott again. But the question has to be asked, are we simply an ad hoc ministry? Do we simply respond to particular times of crisis? Or do we have an ongoing program that also transcends that? And then, of course, the question becomes, how long can we, you know, go on in terms of church support? Part of it's going to depend on the denominations support this ministry. And they've not been increasing their funds. They're already dealing with extended staff that lives in subsistence budgets. And denominations tend to take the attitude, well, maybe it's time to move on to other things. Tired of paying the same issue year after year and seeing another great boycott, deja vu. And people don't understand that you don't organize farm workers overnight. It's not going to be one in 5 years or 10 years or even 25 years. So the church has a ministry to people wherever they are, and you know, the ministry to farm workers at this point is to minister to their powerlessness, and that has to be through organizing. And this is why I'm concerned about the farm worker ministry. I think it needs to be more aggressive in pushing that issue of organizing with the union. Because one of the things we say is we seek to be present with farm workers as they organize under the leadership of the UFW. That's a roundabout answer. It's not a very specific answer. I don't know what the future is going to be. I think we're at a crossroads of time. I think there has to be a lot of reflection about this.
One of the reasons, because I recall when that resolution was passed to make that part of our purpose, or a central part of our purpose, was because the corporations that farm workers have to deal with are by and large national corporations, or have national ties, and
or multinational,
Yeah. And that to win, they needed the support of the church on a national basis, and that was really very much I have it on long play, that's why you probably wonder why it hadn't turned off yet. I had it on long play, so it takes less time. But it raises in my mind a question of how is the church able, what ways does the church have of really mobilizing itself to be able to be supportive to the UFW, where the UFW doesn't have very much work that the ordinary citizen can really do anything about. And my perception is that not having the boycott made a big, big impact on how the churches can support the farm worker movement.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there was a time when Caesar himself said that there really isn't anything for the church to do right now. So if there isn't anything for people to do, they're not going to do it. There are other things to do, other people need it. Mm-hmm. Now he's asking the churches again to do something, which is fine. That's all right.
How is it taking shape? Is that...
Well, right now, he's been back here in New York. His purpose of his visit really was to talk with the heads of... He wanted to talk with the new executive and master council of churches and Catholic bishops and Jewish communities, to get together a kind of investigation group to go out to California to see how the Agriculture Labor Relations Act is being enforced or not being enforced, to get some first-hand information on that. And of course, he's also specifically asked the churches to endorse the boycott. Grapes. Those are very specific requests. Action. So I don't know what you could do beyond specific requests of the church at large. I think there is an ongoing ministry through the National Farmer Ministry that could be part of the whole, certainly an ongoing ministry to the movement of the union, as well as to farm workers elsewhere.
What shape could that take with farm workers elsewhere?
Well, I don't know. At this point, we're not doing this for National Farm Workers, except for Flock, for the Campbell boycott.
Do you see a place for the relief and service kinds of work that had been done in the past, or some sort of separate organizing?
Oh, sure. I mean, you always provide the necessary services to people where you can.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have only limited resources, preferably you provide the resources from the church and change the conditions which make those services needed. So I think we need to be looking at Florida, Texas, from the point of view of how that can begin to happen. The UFW is saying we don't have the resources right now. Well, maybe there are other resources. I don't know. There are other people attempting to organize. There's one group in New Jersey. Organizer is a man named Angel Dominguez. He's head of this organization called CATA. And a friend and I are going to go down and look at that after the Farmers Ministry meeting in May. But right now, the Farm Worker Ministry staff is splintered for a bit because it's not really funded.
Mm-hmm. There's one little question I wanted to ask you. What month was that 1973 meeting in?
I'm trying to think whether it was the end of June or the beginning of July, or whether it was probably would be on that tape.
It might be at the beginning of the tape. I'll play again.
Turn that off and see.